Today on New Letters on the Air, we present one of our seasonal favorites, the widely anthologized short story, The Loudest Voice, read by the author, the late Grace Paley. The story first appeared in print in 1959 in her debut fiction collection called The Little Disturbances of Man, a book that is not only still in print, but is part of Penguin's Great Book series. In 1998, when we had Grace Paley record this for New Letters on the Air at Vermont Public Radio, she said it was the only recording she had ever made of this timeless story about Jewish assimilation into a Christian culture, loosely based on her own Russian immigrant parents.
Oh, oh, my father said, Christmas, what's the harm? After all, history teaches everyone. We learn from reading this is a holiday from pagan times. Also, candles, lights, even like Hanukkah. So we learn it's not altogether Christian. So if they think it's a private holiday, they're only ignorant, not patriotic. What belongs to history belongs to all men.
Stay with us to hear the late Grace Paley read her entire short story, The Loudest Voice, where Christmas and Hanukkah collide. We'll also get a little history lesson in this holiday edition of New Letters on the Air, produced at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm Angela Elam. This time of year, as the days grow shorter, various religions celebrate the eventual coming of the light. For Christians, that light is the birth of Christ and the celebration of Christmas. Everyone knows that Hanukkah falls within the same month as Christmas, but is there a relationship between the two? I asked Rabbi Gerald Kane to not only choose a story for Hanukkah, but also give us a thumbnail sketch of the holiday. Tell me a little bit about the significance of Hanukkah, because I've been told that as far as Jewish holidays go, that it's not one of the more significant holidays.
That's correct. Hanukkah has a seasonal similarity. Hanukkah occurs on the 25th day of the Hebrew month of Kislev. Christmas occurs on the 25th day of December. Now, some years, because the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar, as opposed to the Julian calendar, which we use here in our society today, so that some years Hanukkah falls well before Christmas. But Hanukkah commemorates something entirely different. Despite the fact that light is a symbol in both holidays, Christmas and Hanukkah, Hanukkah represents the victory of a small band of Jews, the Maccabees, over the Syrians who were attempting to destroy them and make them assimilate. So in many ways, it is a celebration of religious freedom. But because it is not written about in the Pentateuch, in the Torah, the central body of Jewish law, it is not a significant Jewish holiday. It's an important Jewish holiday. It's one that's easy to celebrate because it has many symbols and customs. But we have other holidays that occur during the year that have beautiful symbols and customs that aren't celebrated as much. But it's that juxtaposition of Hanukkah and Christmas that people will say, oh, Hanukkah is the Jewish Christmas. Well, it really isn't. And it has provided the fodder for many people, many essayists and rabbis, to talk about what they call the December dilemma. It's further exacerbated by the many interfaith marriages that occur in our society today. And there is not necessarily a conflict, but we have to find some sort of complementary harmony. My very first pulpit in Portland, Oregon, I remember walking into a classroom and hearing a teacher explain it this way, that you can have a birthday and I can be happy that it's your birthday and I can invite you to my birthday party and you can invite me to your birthday party and I'd like you to think about Hanukkah and Christmas in the same way. It is not your birthday, but you can go to someone's house to celebrate their party and vice versa. So it's a very simplistic, it's certainly not a cut and dry answer, but it answered the second graders that I heard explained it to many years ago. But I hope that for those listening where there are questions that might provide at least a small answer.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the story that we have coming up with Grace Paley. You suggested that we get this story, and I'm wondering why. I mean, what's the importance of this particular story, do you think?
Well, I was introduced to The Loudest Voice way back when I was a student at the University of Buffalo. Now it's the State University of New York at Buffalo, which sort of dates me. But I was taking an American Jewish literature course, and I remember being assigned the story by Grace Paley. I knew nothing about Grace Paley. All that I knew was that it was a worthwhile story. And I remember reading it and laughing out loud, because it resonated with a story that my own mother told me. I would guess, having spoken with Grace Paley about it, that it typifies a certain generation of American Jews, Jews who were first-generation Americans who came over from Europe. My mother came over from Lodz, Poland, settled in Paterson, New Jersey, was a good student. She learned English well. And at Christmas time, the teacher asked everyone in the class, is there anyone in here who doesn't have a Christmas tree? So my mother, of course, raised her hand, and the teacher said, well, you're such a good student. The last day of school, I'm going to give you our little tree that I have in the room. And my mother brought the tree home as a reward from this teacher. And my grandparents were apoplectic because, they didn't speak English very well. They were, they were getting settled in the United States. They were trying to maintain their Judaism. And here my mother walks in the house with a Christmas tree. And in many ways, it was like giving the little girl in the story the role of the narrator who is baby Jesus. So it... In many ways, I identified with it, and I think Grace Paley's gift for capturing the dialogue and bringing us the perspective of this little girl listening to these adults, not fully understanding them, really makes the piece a literary gem.
That was Rabbi Gerald Kane. Now let's hear that literary gem, first published in the 1959 collection, The Little Disturbances of Man, a book that is still in print. The author, Grace Paley, kindly agreed to read it, especially for New Letters on the Air.
This story is called The Loudest Voice. It's about a little girl in a school in an immigrant neighborhood in the Bronx. At that time, although most of the children were children of the East European immigration, speaking mostly Polish, Yiddish, or Russian, the teachers were all old-time Americans, maybe. By now, the teachers in the school system, there are many Jews in it, and people of that old East European extraction, but most of the children are Puerto Rican or Black. So that's the way these waves of immigration act in the institutions of the city. The Loudest Voice. There is a certain place where dumbwaiters boom, doors slam, dishes crash. Every window is a mother's mouth, bidding the street shut up. Go skate somewhere else. Come home. My voice is the loudest. There, my own mother is still as full of breathing as me, and the grocer stands up to speak to her. Mrs. Abramowitz, he says, people should not be afraid of their children. Ah, Mr. Bialik, my mother replies, if you say to her or her father, shh, they say, in the grave it will be quiet. From Coney Island to the cemetery, says my papa, it's the same subway, it's the same fare. I am right next to the pickle barrel. My pinky is making tiny whirlpools in the brine. I stop a moment to announce, Campbell's tomato soup, Campbell's vegetable beef soup, Campbell's scotch broth. Be quiet, the grocer says, the labels are coming off. Please, Shirley, be a little quiet, my mother begs me. In that place, the whole street groans, be quiet, be quiet, but steals from the happy chorus of my inside self not a tittle or a jot. There, too, but just around the corner, is a red brick building that has been old for many years. Every morning, the children stand before it in double lines, which must be straight. They are not insulted. They are waiting anyway. I am usually among them. I am, in fact, the first, since I begin with A. One cold morning, the monitor tapped me on the shoulder. "Go to room 409, Shirley Abramowitz," he said. I did as I was told. I went in a hurry up a down staircase to room 409, which contained sixth graders. I had to wait at the desk without wiggling until Mr. Hilton, their teacher, had time to speak. After 5 minutes, he said, "Shirley?" "What?" I whispered. He said, "My, my, Shirley Abramowitz, they told me you had a particularly loud, clear voice and read with lots of expression. Could that be true?" "Oh, yes," I whispered. "In that case, don't be silly. I might very well be a teacher someday. Speak up, speak up." "Yes," I shouted. "More like it," he said. "Now, Shirley, can you put a ribbon in your hair or a bobby pin? It's too messy." "Yes," I bawled. Now, calm down," he turned to the class. "Children, not a sound. Open at page 39, read till 52. When you finish, start again." He looked me over once more. "Now, Shirley, you know, I suppose, that Christmas is coming. We are preparing a beautiful play. Most of the parts have been given out, but I still need a child with a strong voice, lots of stamina. Do you know what stamina is?" "You do. Smart kid. You know, I heard you read 'The Lord is My Shepherd' in assembly yesterday. I was very impressed. Wonderful delivery. Mrs. Jordan, your teacher, speaks highly of you. Now listen to me, Shirley Abramowitz. If you want to take the part and be in the play, repeat after me. I swear to work harder than I ever did before." I looked to heaven and said at once, "Oh, I swear." I kissed my pinky and looked at God. "That is an actor's life, my dear," he explained, "like a soldier's, never tardy or disobedient to his general, the director. Everything he said, absolutely everything, will depend on you." That afternoon, all over the building, children scraped and scrubbed the turkeys and the sheaves of corn off the schoolroom windows. Goodbye, Thanksgiving. The next morning, a monitor brought red paper and green paper from the office. We made new shapes and hung them on the walls and glued them to the doors. The teachers became happier and happier. Their heads were ringing like the bells of childhood. My best friend, Evie, was prone to evil, but she did not get a single demerit for whispering. We learned Holy Night without an error. "How wonderful," said Miss Glacé, the student teacher, "to think that some of you don't even speak the language." We learned Deck the Halls and Hark the Herald Angels. They weren't ashamed, and we weren't embarrassed.
Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King. Peace on earth and mercy mild, God and sinners reconciled. Joyful all ye nations rise, join the triumph of the skies. With the telling cross proclaim, Christ is born in Bethlehem. Hark the herald angels sing, glory to the newborn King.
Oh. But when my mother heard about it all, she said to my father, "Misha, you don't know what's going on there. Kramer is the head of the tickets committee." "Who?" asked my father. "Kramer? Oh, yes, an active woman." "Active? Active has to have a reason." "Listen," she said sadly, "I'm surprised to see my neighbors making tra-la-la for Christmas." My father couldn't think of what to say to that. Then he decided. "You're in America, Clara. You wanted to come here. In Palestine, the Arabs would be eating you alive. Europe, you had pogroms. Argentina is full of Indians. Here you got Christmas. Some joke, huh?" "Very funny, Misha. What is becoming of you? If we came to a new country a long time ago to run away from tyrants, and instead we fall into a creeping pogrom, then our children learn a lot of lies, so what's the joke?" "Ah, Misha, your idealism is going away." So is your sense of humor. That I never had, but idealism you had a lot of. I'm the same Misha Abramovich. I didn't change an iota. Ask anyone. Only ask me, says my mama. May she rest in peace. I got the answer. Meanwhile, the neighbors had to think of what to say, too. Marty's father said, "You know, he has a very important part, my boy." "Mine also," said Mr. Sauerfeld. "Not my boy," said Mrs. Klieg. I said to him, "No, the answer is no. When I say no, I mean no." The rabbi's wife said, "This is disgusting." But no one listened to her. Under the narrow sky of God's great wisdom, she wore a strawberry blonde wig. Every day was noisy and full of experience. I was right-hand man. Mr. Hilton said, "How could I get along without you, Shirley?" He said, "Your mother and father ought to get down on their knees every night and thank God that they have a child like you." He also said, "You're absolutely a pleasure to work with, my dear, dear child." Sometimes he said, "For God's sakes, what did I do with the script? Shirley, find it, Shirley." Then I answered quietly, "Here it is, Mr. Hilton." Once in a while, when he was tired, very tired, he would cry out, "Shirley, I'm just tired of screaming at those kids. Will you tell Ira Pushkov not to come in till Lester points to that star the second time?" Then I roared, "Ira Pushkov, what's the matter with you, dope? Mr. Hilton told you 5 times already, don't come in till Lester points to that star the second time." "Clara," my father asked, "what does she do there till 6 o'clock? She can't even put the plates on the table." "Christmas," said my mother coldly. "Ha, ha," my father said, "Christmas. What's the harm? After all, history teaches everyone. We learn from reading this is a holiday from pagan times. Also, candles, lights, even like Hanukkah. So we learn it's not altogether Christian. So if they think it's a private holiday, they're only ignorant, not patriotic. What belongs to history belongs to all men. You want to go back to the Middle Ages? Is it better to shave your head with a second-hand razor? Does it hurt Shirley to learn to speak up? It does not. So maybe someday she won't live between the kitchen and the shop. She's not a fool." "I thank you, Papa, for your kindness. It is true about me. To this day, I am foolish, but I am not a fool." That night, my father kissed me and said, with great interest in my career, "Shirley, tomorrow's your big day. Congrats." "Save it," my mother said. Then she shut all the windows in order to prevent tonsillitis. In the morning, it snowed. On the street corner, a tree had been decorated for us by a kind city administration. In order to miss its chilly shadow, our neighbors walked 3 blocks east to buy a loaf of bread. The butcher pulled down black window shades to keep the colored lights from shining on his chickens. Not me, oh, not me. On the way to school, with both my hands, I tossed it a kiss of tolerance. Poor thing, it was a stranger in Egypt. I walked straight into the auditorium past the staring children. "Go ahead, Shirley," said the monitors. 4 boys, big for their age, had already started work as prop men and stagehands. Mr. Hilton was very nervous. He was not even happy. Whatever he started to say ended in a sideward look of sadness. He sat slumped in the middle of the first row and asked me to help Miss Glacé. I did this, although she thought my voice too resonant and said, "Show off." Parents began to arrive long before we were ready. They wanted to make a good impression. From among the yards of drapes, I peeked out at the audience. I saw my embarrassed mother. Ira, Lester, and Meyer were pasted to their beards by Miss Glacé. She almost forgot to thread the star on its wire, but I reminded her. I coughed a few times to clear my throat. Miss Glacé looked around and saw that everyone was in costume and online waiting to play his part. She whispered, "All right." Then Jackie Sauerfeld, the prettiest boy in first grade, parted the curtains with his skinny elbow and in a high voice sang out, "Parents dear, we are here to make a Christmas play in time. It we give in narrative and illustrate with pantomime." He disappeared. My voice burst immediately from the wings to the great shock of Ira, Lester, and Meyer, who were waiting for it but were surprised all the same. I remember the house where I was born. Miss Glacé yanked the curtain open, and there it was, the house, an old hayloft, where Celia Cornblue lay in the straw with Cindy Lou, her favorite doll. Ira, Lester, and Meyer moved slowly from the wings toward her, sometimes pointing to a moving star and sometimes ahead to Cindy Lou. It was a long story, and it was a sad story. I carefully pronounced all the words about my lonesome childhood, while little Eddie Brownstein wandered upstage and down with his shepherd's stick looking for sheep. I brought up lonesomeness again and not being understood at all except by some women everybody hated. Eddie was too small for that, and Marty Gruff took his place wearing his father's prayer shawl. I announced 12 friends and half the boys in the fourth grade gathered around Marty, who stood on an orange crate while my voice harangued. Sorrowful and loud, I declaimed about love and God and man, but because of the terrible deceit of A.B. Stock, we came suddenly to a famous moment. Marty, whose remembering tongue I was, waited at the foot of the cross. He stared desperately at the audience. I groaned, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? The soldiers, who were sheiks, grabbed poor Marty to pin him up to die, but he wrenched free, turned again to the audience and spread his arms aloft to show despair and the end. I murmured at the top of my voice, "The rest is silence, but as everyone in this room, in this city, in this world now knows, I shall have life eternal." That night, Miss Cornblue visited our kitchen for a glass of tea. "So how's the Virgin?" asked my father with a look of concern. "For a man with a daughter, you've got a fresh mouth, Abramovich." "Here," said my father kindly, "have some lemon. It'll sweeten your disposition." Then they debated a little in Yiddish, then fell in a puddle of Russian and Polish. What I understood next was my father, who said, "Still in all, it was certainly a beautiful affair, you have to admit, introducing us to the beliefs of a different culture." "Well, yes," said Mrs. Cornblue. "The only thing, you know Charlie Turner, that cute boy in Celia's class, a couple others? They got very small parts, or no part at all, in very bad taste, it seemed to me. After all, it's their religion." "Ah," explained my mother. "What could Mr. Hilton do? They got very small voices. After all, why should they holler? The English language they know from the beginning by heart. They're blonde like angels. You think it's so important they should get in the play? Christmas, the whole piece of goods, they own it." Listened and listened until I couldn't listen anymore. Too sleepy, I climbed out of bed and kneeled. I made a little church of my hands and said, "Hear, O Israel." Then I called out in Yiddish, "Please, good night, good night. Shh." My father said, "Shh, yourself," and slammed the kitchen door. I was happy. I fell asleep at once. I had prayed for everybody, my talking family, cousins far away, passers-by, and all the lonesome Christians. I expected to be heard. My voice was certainly the loudest.
Kemach, kemach, min hasa,
shemen, shemen, min haka,
Hanukkah hayom,
chag na'im lechman,
la, 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 la
You just heard the widely anthologized story, The Loudest Voice, read by the late Grace Paley, punctuated with music from the Hanukkah story, sung by the Western Wind Ensemble, and from Festival of Light, compiled by Robert Duskus and Bob Apple, as well as Itzhak Perlman's Tradition and Vince Guaraldi's A Charlie Brown Christmas, Mickey Katz's Simcha Time, and David Tara's Yiddish American Klezmer Music, 1925 to 1956. Our recording of Grace Paley was made especially for New Letters on the Air in 1998 at Vermont Public Radio. The story was originally published in 1959 in her debut collection, The Little Disturbances of Man, which is still in print. It's also included in her collected stories that came out in 2007, the year Grace Paley died at age 84. She served as the Poet Laureate of Vermont and years before as the state author of New York, the two places where she divided her time. Two earlier interviews with Grace Paley, one about her poetry and the other about her fiction, are in our audio archive on the website, newletters.org. While you're there, consider purchasing a gift subscription of New Writing and Art with New Letters Magazine. If you appreciate the work, you can also make a tax-deductible donation. Individual supporters not only help the magazine directly, but strengthen the ability to raise and match funds from other sources. Look for the support tab on the website. That's newletters.org. If you'd like to join our Save New Letters on the Air team to help bring you new programming in the new year, call and leave a message at 888-548-2477 or email radio@newletters.org. That toll-free number again is 888-LIT-AIRS. Just as a reminder, without us, this recording of the late Grace Paley would not exist. Originally produced with Margaret Smith, Laura Spencer, and Linda Scher, thanks also goes to those who have helped tweak this classic over the years: Dennis Conroe, Alex Smith, Eric Motter, Danette Alexander, Annie Walsh, Stephanie Hughes, and Jamie Walsh. From New Letters on the Air, past and present, we wish you happy holidays and leave you with these words from 2020 Pulitzer Prize winning poet Jericho Brown.
Listening to radio shows like this one when I was in graduate school was a big deal to me. You know, I would look online and see who had given an interview that week and I would listen to it. And so what happens is we think, oh, one day I might get to be on New Letters on the Air. So, hey, I'm having my day.
That's right.
I finally made it, baby. It's time to celebrate.
Listen for Jericho Brown and others from our more than 40 years of broadcasting creative writers of poetry, fiction, essays, and plays who have gone on to become MacArthur Genius Fellows, Poets Laureate, and winners of many major awards and prizes, along with lesser-known but still powerful writers who can question yet comfort our world. Any ideas on how to help us find our way out of the dark and into the light are welcome. Write to radio@newletters.org. I'm Angela Elam, and as always, I thank you for listening to New Letters on the Air.